We're here at Menards Bag Sale, asking shoppers what they're putting in the bag to get 15% off.
Paint.
Batteries.
Tools.
Toilet paper.
Extension cords. Grocery items.
Hardware for my cabinets.
Snack items. Crackers and some canned good stuff.
Shop vac supplies.
Toothpaste, cereal, coffee, dog treats. I've got a lot of stuff to grab.
The list goes on, but the sale ends January 24th. Hurry in for Menards 15% off bag sale. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive, the show built entirely for you, our expert listener, where we take the essential context, the core sources, and the crucial insights, and distill them into knowledge you can immediately use.
Today, we are undertaking a massive project. We're trying to decode what might be the most successful act of self-invention in Hollywood history.
We are diving deep into Cary Grant, a man who, you know, is consistently ranked as the absolute definition of cinematic stardom during Hollywood's golden age.
Right. And our mission today is to get behind that flawless public image. We need to analyze the turbulent, deeply traumatic origins that fueled his need for escape.
And examine his career moves, which were frankly revolutionary. I mean, his pioneering freelance model, his extraordinary business acumen.
Exactly. And then confront the complex personal life, the inner turmoil that was constantly threatening to, you know, shatter the entire facade.
Because the core question here really is the mechanism of reinvention. How did an impoverished boy from a broken home in Bristol, England, consciously and relentlessly invent the sophisticated leading man that everyone wanted to be?
So we're tracing the architect of charm, starting right at the beginning, with the very difficult, dark foundations of a boy named Archibald Leach.
To really understand the perfection of Cary Grant, you have to start with the trauma of Archie Leach. He was born in Horfield, Bristol in 1904, and this was a decidedly working-class environment.
Oh, very. His father, Elias James Leach, was a tailor's presser, and his mother, Elsie Maria Leach, was a seamstress.
And it's important to clarify what a tailor's presser actually was. This wasn't some, you know, master tailor. This was hard manual labor.
Right. It was a physically demanding factory job. Steaming, shaping, pressing garments. It's a world away from the kind of effortless wealth that Grant would later project on screen.
A really gritty, difficult life. And it was made so much worse almost immediately by a family tragedy.
Yes. The family was fractured right from the start. Grant was the second child, but his older brother John died of tuberculous meningitis just days before Grant's own first birthday.
And that loss, as all the biographers document, had this just crippling effect on his mother, Elsie.
She just never recovered. The grief, the self-blame. Yeah. It led to a lifelong struggle with what we now call clinical depression.
And the sources say she became incredibly emotionally distant, sort of unable to give or maybe even receive affection, which created a really unstable emotional environment for the young Archibald.
Her coping mechanism was just extreme rigidity. She was fiercely anti-alcohol, anti-tobacco, and would enforce discipline ruthlessly, you know, reducing his tiny bit of pocket money for the smallest mishaps.
In Grant himself, he later said that his lifelong, often very negative and tumultuous relationships with women came directly from this mix of overprotectiveness and just profound emotional coldness.
So he's being raised by a traumatized mother mm-hmm. who is both fiercely protective and at the same time completely emotionally unavailable.
But the real deep-seated betrayal, the thing that really defined his need to escape reality, that happened when he was just 9 years old.
That's the great deception. In 1913, his father, Elias James, who was by this point sinking deeper into his own alcoholism, had his mother committed. He institutionalized her in Glenside Hospital, a mental asylum.
And instead of telling his son the truth, which would have been heartbreaking enough, the father, he commits this act of just profound psychological violence.
He tells the 9-year-old boy that his mother has gone away on a long holiday.
And then eventually he escalates that lie. He tells Archibald that she had died, just gone. A child suddenly facing the complete, inexplicable erasure of his mother.
Can you imagine? That is an unbelievable burden of betrayal that Grant carried for decades. He didn't find out his mother was still alive until he was 31.
31. And the confession only came because his father was on his deathbed.
Think about the psychological architecture that builds. I mean, a profound distrust of reality, a total reliance on self-sufficiency, and this relentless lifelong need to control his environment.
Exactly. The emotional world was chaos. So the world of performance, of structure, that became his refuge. This need to escape is what fueled his early attraction to the theater.
Right. He was going to pantomimes with his father. He was hanging around backstage at the Bristol Hippodrome, just drawn to the spectacle, the glamour. the order of it all.
He tried the normal path for a bit. He attended Fairfield Grammar School on a scholarship between 1915 and 1918. He was smart, good at sports,
but incredibly rebellious. He hated the traditional subjects, you know, math and Latin. He got a reputation for mischief and just flat out refused to do his homework.
Which leads directly to what seems to be a very calculated escape. At age 14, March 13th, 1918, he's expelled from Fairfield.
The official reasons are a bit murky. Something about being found in the girls' lavatory or helping with a minor theft. But one of his biographers, Wansel, he suggests that Archibald's actions were totally intentional.
He wanted to get expelled.
He deliberately got himself thrown out so he could pursue a career in entertainment. Formal education was a dead end for him. The stage was freedom.
And that is the first real, concrete step in his self-creation. Immediately after being expelled, he joins the Bob Pender stage troupe, the Penders, as a stilt walker and an acrobat.
And this wasn't just, you know, a fun job. This was a rigorous physical apprenticeship. He was learning balance, comedic timing, coordination, physical control.
The exact skills he would need for the kind of sophisticated light comedy he'd later dominate in Hollywood.
Absolutely. The seeds of the suave, physically graceful Cary Grant were literally sown while he was walking on stilts as a teenager in Bristol.
The trauma of the past was being physically channeled into a skill set for the future. So Archibald Leach takes these hard-won skills, born from the chaos of vaudeville, and he points them straight at America. July 1920, he's still only 16 years old, and he's touring the U.S. with the Pender Troupe on the RMS Olympic.
And this is such a crucial moment. This is where the persona gets its first major role model. Because on that voyage over, he played shuffleboard with Douglas Fairbanks,
who at the time was the absolute icon of dashing physical American stardom. The biggest star in the world, really.
And Grant, or, well, Leach at the time, he later admitted he just observed Fairbanks meticulously. He was noting his mannerisms, his physical ease, his whole debonair flair. He was already studying the blueprint of the star he wanted to become.
The troupe did incredibly well in New York. They performed at the massive, what was it, nearly 6,000 seats, the New York Hippodrome, for 9 months.
A huge success. But when the rest of the Penders went home, Leach saw his chance, a permanent escape from Bristol. And he decided to stay in the U.S. and just plunge himself into the grueling American vaudeville circuit.
Yeah, and the grind was relentless.
Oh, completely. Yeah. He worked as part of acts like the Knockabout Comedians and the Walking Stanleys. He was doing comic sketches, juggling, developing his acrobatics. He was even billed as rubber legs for his contortionist skills. This was the real training ground for his famous comedic timing.
You can see the dedication in the side jobs, too. He was hired as a stilt walker, wearing this bright greatcoat and a sandwich board to attract crowds on the newly opened Coney Island boardwalk.
It's literally a walking advertisement, constantly performing for the public, honing his craft in most direct way possible.
And all those years of constant public interaction, moving between American cities and UK music halls, it forced a fundamental change in his speech.
Yes. His accent, which started with his subtle Cockney bass, you know, the typical working-class London markers, it had to be neutralized.
This is the linguistic architecture of Cary Grant. He consciously evolved it into that distinctive transatlantic or mid-Atlantic way of speaking.
And it's not just about sounding posh. It was about sounding classless in the best possible way.
Right. It was a manufactured accent that sounded educated but not regionally specific. It was suitable for a British drawing room or an American diner.
Exactly. It was a tool of universal employability. He made the conscious choice to sound like he was from nowhere in particular, and that fluidity became absolutely central to the Cary Grant persona.
By 1927, he's getting work on Broadway, making $75 a week playing juvenile leads. But the reviews, they were pretty mixed. The persona wasn't quite there yet.
No, not at all. One critic, trying to pin him down, sort of derisively called his early acting a mixture of John Barrymore and Cockney.
He struggled with failing productions, like a musical called Polly. And even when he got a role in a risque comedy called Boom Boom, his co-star, Jeanette MacDonald, admitted he was absolutely terrible in the role.
She said only his undeniable charm saved the show from being a total failure. So he had the charisma, but not yet the technique or that defined screen identity.
That transition from stage performer to cinematic star finally happens in December 1931. After a screen test, the 27-year-old Archibald Leach signs a 5-year contract with Paramount Pictures.
Starting at $450 a week, which was a fortune compared to his vaudeville days.
But the studio system required uniformity, And Paramount's general manager, B.P. Schulberg, he demanded a name change. He wanted something that sounded, and I quote, more all-American like Gary Cooper.
Right. Schulberg vetoed Archibald Leach immediately. Mm-hmm. Famously, he said it sounded too British and fruity.
So they settled on Cary Grant. The surname was just chosen from a studio list of options. Grant, for his part, was relieved to shed the old name. He admitted that Archie just doesn't sound right in America. It doesn't sound particularly right in Britain either.
And just like that, Cary Grant was born. Not out of some artistic vision, but out of a commercial rebranding effort.
And with that new name, the mission became crystal clear. He set out consciously to establish himself as the epitome of masculine glamour.
His film debut came in 1932, This is the Night. Then he was playing a wealthy playboy opposite Marlene Dietrich in Blonde Venus. He was working, but he hadn't yet hit that critical mass.
The rocket fuel for his career arrived in 1933. His pairing with Mae West in the Precode films, She'd Done Him Wrong and I'm No Angel.
And the Precode context is so important here. This is before the strict enforcement of the Hays Code in 34, so the films could be much more sexually frank, cynical, and funny.
Mae West was the undisputed queen of that saucy, subversive style, and she used Grant's masculine beauty and physical ease perfectly.
No Angel was an absolute commercial monster.
Yeah.
It was so successful that history credits it with reportedly saving Paramount Pictures from bankruptcy.
Wow. And Grant's salary jumped to $750 a week almost overnight. Mae West later claimed she discovered him, which is a bit of an exaggeration.
But she certainly gave him the platform he needed. The problem was that success was followed by a string of commercial failures. Films like Born to be Bad and Kiss and Makeup just didn't work.
And combined with all the press rumors about his personal life, Paramount started seeing him as, well, as expendable.
But then he gets loaned out to RKO Pictures. His first collaboration with Katharine Hepburn, George Cukor's Sylvia Scarlett in 1935, was a total commercial flop. People hated it.
And yet Grant himself considered it his personal breakthrough. The role where he finally felt comfortable on screen, it showed he was learning to act like Cary Grant.
And right here is the moment that defines him as a revolutionary businessman. When his Paramount contract ends in 1936, instead of signing with another big studio, Grant makes the radical decision to work freelance.
He wasn't just an actor anymore, he became a principal.
He claimed to be the first freelance actor in Hollywood. Now, historians debate if he was literally the first, but he was certainly the first powerful enough to make it stick and define the model for future stars.
And the studios must have been shocked.
Oh, completely. Shock and skepticism. The studios thrived on controlling actors' lives and careers for minimal pay. Grant broke that chain entirely. That independence gave him unprecedented power to choose his stories, directors, co-stars. He dictated his terms, not the other way around.
And that autonomy was validated almost immediately. He secured these lucrative joint contracts with RKO and Columbia, and then in 1937, he starred in The Awful Truth.
And that was it. A critical and commercial smash that solidified the sophisticated light comedy persona. The director, Leo McCarey, encouraged him to improvise, to draw on all those deep vaudeville and rubber leg skills.
So the ability to blend that physical comedy with drawing room elegance, it was the perfect application of Archibald Leach's early training.
Exactly. The Cary Grant we all know, effortlessly witty, slightly baffled, intensely charming, he was officially launched.
The success of The Awful Truth wasn't just a hit. It launched what one critic called the most spectacular run ever for an actor in American pictures. Grant moved straight into the high-octane golden age of screwball comedy.
Yeah, that period between 1937 and 1940 is just his comedic zenith. You see him opposite Katharine Hepburn in bringing up Baby in 38. The sheer chaos of that film. A paleontologist, a missing bone, a leopard.
And it showcased his unique ability to look utterly immaculate while simultaneously being completely and utterly befuddled.
Then you have the Howard Hawks masterpiece, His Girl Friday, from 1940. He played the ruthlessly charismatic editor Walter Burns opposite Rosalind Russell. And that film is just famous for its astonishingly fast dialogue.
The verbal athleticism.
It's the speed. Screwball comedy relies on actors who can articulate complex lines at double speed while maintaining perfect physical timing for the gags.
And his vaudeville background, where timing was everything for a trick or a joke, made him uniquely equipped for that. He brought an acrobat's precision to dialogue.
He closes out that incredible run by reuniting with Hepburn for The Philadelphia Story in 1940. Critically, it was enormous. Commercially, huge. And yet, Grant was profoundly disappointed not to get an Oscar nomination.
Even though his co-stars Hepburn and James Stewart both did, Stewart won, in fact.
And that disappointment, it really reveals the fierce ambition behind that charming facade.
Mm.
Grant famously joked he'd have to blacken my teeth first before the Academy will take me seriously.
Right. And Stewart's win was widely seen as a sort of makeup Oscar for him being snubbed for Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. It just highlighted that even at his peak, the Academy valued dramatic suffering way more than comedic mastery.
That snub seemed to spur him toward more dramatic work. He soon earned his first Academy Award nomination for Best Actor for the tearjerker Penny Serenade in 1941.
And then a second nomination for None But the Lonely Heart in 1944. He was proving he wasn't just a funny face.
Meanwhile, his roots were changing officially. He became a
bag huge savings on your painting projects at Menards. From your kitchen and bath to doors and trim, and even your ceilings, Dutch Boy has the perfect choice for your painting projects. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is a tough paint and primer that provides great scrub resistance and durability. DuraFighter interior paint starts at $27.75 a gallon. Get an additional 15% savings on all Dutch Boy paints when you put it in the bag. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
Naturalized U.S. citizen in June 1942, legally changing his name to Cary Grant. He was 38.
And with that commitment to America, he got heavily involved in the war effort, touring, appearing in propaganda shorts like Road to Victory.
And before we get to Hitchcock, we have to mention Arsenic and Old Lace from 1944.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beloved dark comedy, but Grant, he absolutely despised it.
Hated it. He played the manic Mortimer Brewster and just considered it the worst, most over-the-top performance of his entire career. It seems the control of that charming man persona was completely disrupted by overt farce.
That discomfort with overt darkness or chaos brings us perfectly to Alfred Hitchcock. They made four films together, and Hitchcock was brilliant because he intentionally cast Grant in these darker, morally ambiguous characters. He challenged the very foundation of Grant's suave persona. He used the charm against the audience.
Their first film, Suspicion in 1941, is a masterclass in ambiguity. Grant's character is simultaneously charming and sinister.
And the film was originally supposed to end with Grant being the murderer. But studio pressure, they were fueled by this idea that the public just couldn't accept Cary Grant as a killer. It forced Hitchcock to change the ending and prove Grant was innocent.
Hitchcock later admitted that the conventional happy ending was a creative mistake, caused entirely by the power of Grant's persona. The actor's inherent likability was so strong, it actually defied the plot.
That lesson informed their later, greater work. In Notorious from 46, with Ingrid Bergman, the ambiguity is still there. Grant plays this cynical government agent, Devlin, who has to watch the woman he loves infiltrate a Nazi ring.
That film is so iconic, especially for that famous kiss.
Right, a major violation of the 2-second rule the Hays Code imposed on kisses. Grant and Bergman shared one of the longest kisses in film history, about 2.5 minutes, by breaking it up with little bits of dialogue and movement. It shows he was willing to push boundaries when the script demanded it.
And their final two collaborations were these incredibly stylish capers. To Catch a Thief in 55 with Grace Kelly,
who he called possibly the finest actress I've ever worked with.
And then the ultimate masterpiece of cinematic paranoia, North by Northwest in 1959.
North by Northwest is often celebrated as the definitive Grant performance.
Yeah.
A huge commercial triumph. And it also cemented his fashion legacy through one single iconic costume, that custom-made mid-gray Savile Row suit.
And that suit is so important. It's the sartorial paradox of the whole Cary Grant image.
Because the suit never fails. I mean, in this film, Grant is constantly under physical duress. He's kidnapped, nearly driven off a cliff, attacked by a crop duster, climbing Mount Rushmore.
Yet the suit never wrinkles, never tears. He never loses that refined composure.
The perfect tailoring is a symbol of the imperviousness of the Cary Grant persona, even in the face of violent chaos. It's the ultimate expression of control.
But despite that consistent excellence, the early 1950s brought a film slump. Movies like Crisis and People Will Talk just didn't land. The pressure of maintaining that perfection started to wear on him.
He made what might be his most telling confession at the time. He said, "To play yourself, your true self, is the hardest thing in the world."
The exhaustion, the disillusionment, it was very real. After the failure of Dreamwife in 1953, Grant was convinced his film career was over, and he took a brief but significant break from the industry.
But that break was exactly what he needed. To Catch a Thief in 1955 completely revitalized his career.
And he followed that with The Timeless Romance, An Affair to Remember in 57, and then smash hits like Indiscreet and Operation Petticoat. He closed out the decade as the most popular, highest-grossing film star in the world.
What's truly fascinating about Cary Grant is how the meticulous nature he used to craft his persona extended directly into the practical worlds of finance and business. He's consistently called one of the shrewdest businessmen ever to operate in Hollywood.
And it all starts with that pioneering move to go freelance in 1936. By escaping the studio contracts, he secured not just artistic freedom, but total financial independence. He realized the star could hold the leverage, not the studio.
And he translated that leverage into unprecedented profit sharing. Unlike standard contracts, which gave actors a salary and maybe a small percentage of the net profits, which studios were famous for obscuring, Grant negotiated a share of the gross revenue.
Meaning he got paid directly off the ticket sales before the studio deducted any of their expenses.
It was revolutionary.
Yeah.
And it made him immensely wealthy. To get technical, for films like To Catch a Thief, Grant basically set up his own production company, which he then leased back to the studio for his services. This let him manage his own taxes and revenue share directly.
And the numbers are just staggering.
For his 10% share of the gross of To Catch a Thief, Grant received over $700,000. Alfred Hitchcock, the director and producer, got less than $50,000 for the same film.
Wow. That disparity just shows he mastered Hollywood's financial structure just as completely as he mastered its comedic timing.
He wasn't just rich. He's meticulous. His friend David Niven said Grant seemed to have a computer in his brain before computers were even a thing. He accumulated a lot of real estate and was obsessively detailed in managing his assets. He was determined to never go back to the poverty of Archie Leach.
And this dedication to business continued even after he retired from film in 1966. He didn't just fade away. He jumped into corporate management.
Right. He sat on the board of the cosmetics firm Fabergé. He got a modest salary, $15,000 a year, but he was active. He went to meetings. He traveled internationally to promote the brand.
And his influence was measurable. Grant's star power and business input helped Fabergé grow its annual revenues to nearly $50 million by 1968, a huge growth rate.
And that position gave him perks, like access to a private plane, which he strategically used to fly and visit his only daughter, Jennifer. The business acumen served the personal priority.
He also served as a director for MGM Films, MGM Grand Hotels, Hollywood Park, Western Airlines. I mean, he truly diversified his interests far beyond simple celebrity endorsement. He proved he was a capable executive.
Now, if we switch from the incredible control he had over his business life to the chaos that often plagued his emotional life, This is where the persona really fractured.
He was married 5 times, a constant search for the stability he never had as a child.
His marriages included Virginia Sherrill, which was a brief, tumultuous year that ended with charges he'd hit her, and then the famous union with Barbara Hutton, the Woolworth heiress, which got them the tabloid nickname, Cash and Carrie.
But crucially, Grant refused any financial settlement in a prenup. He was determined to show he wasn't marrying her for money.
His longest marriage from 1949 to 1962 was to Betsy Drake. And she had a profound influence on him. She's the one who introduced him to psychology and psychoanalysis, which later led to his more radical therapies.
And his final and probably most profound relationship was with his daughter, Jennifer. She was born during his very tumultuous marriage to Diane Cannon.
He frequently called Jennifer his best production. And he retired from film in 1966 specifically to raise her and provide the stable fatherhood he never had. That marriage to Cannon, though, it ended with very painful accusations that Grant was emotionally abusive toward her.
And the constant turbulence of his private life is what fuels the long-standing, intense speculation about his sexuality. The sources paint a very complex picture, starting in his early New York days.
Well, he lived with the costume designer Ori Kelly from 1925 to 1931. Biographers describe this as a volatile, on-and-off relationship that spanned 3 decades. Ori Kelly himself was very vocal about their emotional closeness.
And even more famously, he lived with the actor Randolph Scott, off and on, for 12 years, starting in 1932. This was a time when both of them were rising stars.
And the photos of them living together relaxed, often in matching outfits, doing domestic chores, that became tabloid fodder for decades.
Whether their relationship was romantic remains a point of intense biographical dispute.
It does. Some contemporaries, like the fashion arbiter Richard Blackwell, claimed in his autobiography that Grant and Scott were deeply, madly in love. Another source suggests Grant later confessed that he and Scott had been bisexual and that it was the first time he had ever been in love.
But it's all a zone of contradictory claims. His daughter, Jennifer, has firmly denied her father was bisexual, yet his ex-wife, Diane Cannon, believed he was queer.
What is undeniable is the intense measures Grant took to protect his manufactured image. He sued Chevy Chase for slander in 1980 for publicly calling him a homo. The lawsuit just demonstrated his total commitment to controlling the public narrative, even late in his life.
And that leads directly to maybe the most unusual aspect of his attempt to reconcile the Archie Leach trauma with the Cary Grant perfection, the LSD experimentation.
Right. Starting in the late 1950s, he began taking the drug, heavily influenced by his wife Betsy Drake's interest in psychoanalysis.
And this wasn't recreational. This was a desperate psychological tool. He was treated by a radiologist named Mortimer Hartman and is estimated to have had about 100 sessions over several years.
And the goal was simple: to tear down the deep-seated psychological defenses and rid himself of the emotional turmoil from his childhood, the deception, his failed relationships, all of it.
Initially, he saw the drug as the solution. He said that for the first time, he was truly, deeply, and honestly happy. He felt he was finally able to see himself outside the defensive shell he had built.
He was using this radical, unregulated substance in a desperate attempt to perform psychological surgery on the Archie Leach hiding beneath the grand facade.
But that positive view didn't last forever. He later recanted, admitting that taking LSD was an utterly foolish thing to do.
But he immediately qualified that. He said it was necessary for him to strip away the layers of defenses, hypocrisy, and vanity that he'd accumulated while painstakingly constructing the Cary Grant identity. The therapy was a brutal admission that the flawless public image was built on a foundation of profound psychological pain.
By 1966, after his final film, Walk, Don't Run, Grant retired from the screen. He was just thoroughly disillusioned with the changing landscape of cinema. He felt the golden age had definitively ended after Charade in 63.
And he prioritized fatherhood. He said he had discovered more important things in life than acting, and that was providing the stability for Jennifer that he never received.
He largely avoided any kind of comeback, famously joked "fat chance" when anyone asked if he would return. His later years were devoted to his business interests, especially Fabergé, and a series of tours called A Conversation with Cary Grant.
Right, where he'd show clips and answer audience questions. An exercise he admitted with that characteristic self-deprecation was largely ego fodder.
He stayed in relatively good health until the end. He had a mild stroke in 1984 and then died of a massive stroke in Davenport, Iowa on November 29, 1986. He was 82 and he was just about to do one of his shows.
And critically, in a final act of control, he initially refused to be taken to the hospital. He insisted he was fine before deteriorating rapidly. That refusal to surrender control, even to medical professionals, seems a fitting, if tragic, end for a man who spent his life managing his own image and fate.
The public reaction was one of just disbelief. The New York Times captured it perfectly, writing that Cary Grant was not supposed to die. Cary Grant was supposed to stick around, our perpetual touchstone of charm and elegance and romance and youth.
And in accordance with his wishes, his body was cremated and no public funeral was held. The greatest public performer chose a quiet, private end.
When you look back at his critical reception, what stands out is that paradox of his charm, that unique ability to mix, polish, and pratfalls in successive scenes without ever compromising his inherent masculinity.
Director George Cukor noted that Grant's magic wasn't arrogance. He acted as though he were just an ordinary young man who happened to be extremely handsome, which made it all the more appealing when that seemingly ordinary man turned out to be incredibly witty and physically agile. He was refreshingly able to play the near fool, the fey idiot.
Pauline Kael captured the mass appeal perfectly. Mm. She described him as the most publicly seduced male the world has ever known. Men wanted to be him because he showed that masculinity could be effortless, and women wanted to date him because he was sensitive.
She also highlighted his progressive approach, noting he treated his female co-stars as subjects with multiple qualities rather than treating them as sex objects.
Stanley Donen, who directed him in several hits, was very clear. His magic wasn't some inherent genius. It came from enormous amounts of work on minute details. He was a professional, constantly refining the delivery, the timing, the suit, the entire performance.
And that brings us full circle to his most telling self-assessment, the ultimate confession about the meticulous, conscious creation of his own identity. He acknowledged that he played at being the person he wanted to be until I became that person.
The deep, buried trauma of Archibald Leach was systematically channeled into the perfection of Cary Grant.
The praise from those who knew him best was universal. Stanley Donen, Howard Hawks, film historian David Thompson. They all considered him the greatest and most important actor in cinema history. And Alfred Hitchcock, who was famously reserved about his collaborators, called him the only actor I ever loved in my whole life.
He did eventually get official recognition for that unique mastery, though it took a while. After a 12-year personal boycott of the ceremony, partly fueled by Academy members who disliked his history of frivolous lawsuits to protect his image, he received the Academy Honorary Award in 1970.
A moment of late public reconciliation for a man who had otherwise mastered his career entirely on his own terms.
So, we've completed the journey. From Archibald Leach, the impoverished, traumatized boy in Bristol, to Cary Grant, the Hollywood legend and incredibly successful businessman. We've dissected the profound contrasts. Deep childhood trauma masked by lighthearted comic genius and the relentless construction of his self-proclaimed best production, the flawless Cary Grant persona.
It is a remarkable case study in self-reinvention driven by deep-seated necessity. Grant often joked that the real Cary Grant was far more like the scruffy, unshaven fisherman in Father Goose than the well-tailored charmer of Charade. So if the life he lived on screen and in public was simply the conscious embodiment of the man he desperately wished he could have been, what does that tell us about the hidden transformative power of consciously performing the self you aspire to become?
What parts of ourselves are we currently acting into existence? That's something for you to mull over until the next deep dive.